Hi, welcome to the Panic Pixie Scream Girls podcast about horror, anxiety, and feminism with Holly and Becky. Before we started, we just wanted to let you know that this podcast contains discussions about alcoholism, domestic violence, child abuse, mental illness, murder, and much more. A full list of content warnings is available in the description. Oh, there's one other thing that I need to tell you. This episode does contain a spoiler for the film Under the Skin, so just warning you in case you haven't seen it. Don't say we didn't warn you. Hello, Panic Pixies. Welcome to another episode. And this time we're talking about one of my favourite films, The Shining by Stanley Kubrick. Panic Pixies is a podcast by Holly and Becky where we talk about horror films and we talk about our responses to them in relation to anxiety and mental health, but also the feminine experience. Holly, do you want to tell us a bit about the film?
Yep, so this is a 1980 film directed by Stanley Kubrick based on the Stephen King novel of the same title from 1977. It's about a man called Jack Torrance, played by Jack Nicholson, who gets a job as a caretaker at a hotel out of season in the winter. There are no guests and he's looking after it, and he takes his wife Wendy, played by Shelley Duvall, and his young son Danny with him to live in this deserted hotel over the winter, and shit gets weird.
Nicely summed up there.
Thanks. So Becky, this is your choice of film this time, although I also love it. So what does this film mean to you and why does it scare you?
That's a good question. So one of the reasons that I love this film is probably that it's directed by Stanley Kubrick. He's probably one of my favourite directors. I'm always attracted to directors that can be called auteurs, which basically means directors who have a very distinct style and a very specific way of doing things. And Stanley Kubrick particularly pays a lot of attention to the kind of mise-en-scene of films. Like, everything that's in the shot is there for a reason. He's meticulously researched and thought about everything. Nothing is there by mistake or just because. And that lends itself to multiple and complex readings of the films, but also it just creates so much atmosphere, and he's so good at creating atmosphere. And that's what I love about this film. There is so much atmosphere to this film that it just permeates it and it sits with you for a long time afterwards. In many ways, if you reduce it down, it's kind of just a ghost house film. It's just a ghost story. It's a hotel with ghosts in it, if you reduce it down to its bare minimum. But there's so much more to that, and there's so much layered on top of it. And I do love the way that it really creeps up on you, much like the kind of sinister music of the film just sort of creeps up on you and suddenly gets you.
That's interesting. So there's not a particular theme or scenario that grabbed you, it's just more the overall kind of feel of it. Do you like other kind of slow burn horrors?
Yeah, definitely. I think a lot of the horrors that we've talked about generally, and the ones that probably I find the scariest, tend to be those sort of slow burn ones that really stick with you or stay with you or catch you unawares. I'm less scared by the more obvious horror and, you know, jump scares and things. They don't do too much for me. I'm not like you. you jump out of your skin when there's a jump scare. I can usually tell when it's coming. I know it's happening, and I very rarely jump. So those kind of films don't really work so well for me. But these kind of ones, this is like slow sinisterness. There are other things about it that I think appealed to me. So one of the things that I think really resonated for me with this film is that I grew up in a very large house. And I'm an only child. So I spent a lot of my time wandering about this big house and playing on my own and coming up with all my own stories and imagination. I was a very creative child. You are when you're an only child. And sometimes, you know, you would get scared or you would think you would see things and stuff. And so there was a lot of the scenes about Danny playing in the hotel on his own that just really connected to me to that fear that I would sometimes feel as a child. Often probably irrationally, but there were a couple of instances where things really scared me. There's a great story which I love, which I'll tell you about.
Please do.
When I was little, I was playing on my own and my mum was in the house doing housework and she was getting annoyed with me being under her feet, so she told me to go and play in the garden. So I went to go out the front door and I saw two lions in the garden. So obviously I was like probably about five or something at the time, maybe six. I screamed and went running to my mum and she's like, "What now?" And I'm like, "There's lions in the garden. Like, don't be so ridiculous." So she comes to the window. She can't see any lions. She's like, "There are no lions." She tells me to go outside, but I'm too scared at that point. So I didn't go outside and went to play in my room. Anyway, it turns out a couple of days later, there's a wildlife park near us. And my mum found out that some wolves had escaped from the wildlife park, which is very near to where we lived. And I'd probably seen two wolves, but for some reason in my small young person's brain, I thought they were lions.
Holy moly.
So she nearly sent me out to play with the wolves. They did get them all, by the way. They did get them back.
Oh my God.
For a short period.
Wow.
So yeah, there you go. So sometimes when you think you see something scary, this has always stayed with me, and you look away and then you look back and it's not there and you go, "Oh, I'm just not seeing something." Sometimes you did see something.
Yeah.
That's kind of a scary thought, isn't it? There's a scene with Danny in the film where he sees something scary. I think it's the twins. Often parodied, most people remember the twins. Well, they're not actually twins. They're actually supposed to be different ages, but they're dressed so they look like twins. And he puts his hands over his eyes and looks scared and then takes his hands off his eyes and they've gone. And so it's very reminiscent of that to me. Like, they were actually there. He's just praying that they go and then they go. So what about the film did you find scary, or did you not find it scary?
Oh, I definitely did. I think I saw it for the first time when I was at uni. And I found it, like, mildly creepy, but not. I think it had been hyped up so much, and I was like, "Oh, this is the most scary film of all time." But oh, just, like, mildly creepy. But I think I found it more tense as an adult in terms of the relationships. I think that scared me more, the kind of the growing menace from Jack and Wendy's kind of fear, and that, and Danny's fear as well.
There's a lot about, and it's done very well, about a boy loving his father, but also being scared of his father. The complexity of the two sides of that emotion.
Yeah, because there's a lot more about that. I mean, we'll probably talk a bit more about the book, like, because we both read the book as well. But the character of Jack is a lot more fleshed out and kind of nuanced in the book. And he also kind of loves his son and gets angry with his son, and also had an abusive father who he also adored. You know, it's just all the complicated, guilty, shameful, loving feelings.
Yeah, and I think that's quite an interesting point about the hotel. So the Overlook Hotel, where this all takes place, is kind of the architect of everything that happened. Mm. It's a character in itself. The hotel itself is portrayed as being scary. And in some level, it shouldn't be. It's this nice sort of in the mountains, relaxing holiday destination, but in every way that it's portrayed and filmed, it looks sinister and it looks foreboding, and you just have a sense of the menace of the hotel somehow controlling all of this. And there's a question for me about, is Jack drawn to the hotel because he has a darkness within him that speaks to the hotel, that the hotel knows and then it pulls out of him, or is it that the hotel just sort of overtakes him in some way?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Interestingly, in the book, he gets a job because of his old mate from AA, who's his sponsor, and he kind of gets him the job, even though the actual manager, like, hates him in the interview. He absolutely hates him. He's just like, "I don't think you're right for this. I don't think you should get this job. But nevertheless, my hands are tied," you know?
Yeah, which is pretty different to how it's been made in the film, actually.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's just Jack Nicholson, because then I was trying to think of if I've seen anything where he was just a kind of a likable, sincere, trustworthy character.
There's a couple of like sort of romantic comedies that he did later on in his life where he does come across like that. But yeah, certainly in his earlier films, he plays the deranged, evil or possibly evil character very well.
Because I think in the book, it seems like at the start, they're kind of hopeful because their marriage is under some strain and things, and they're hopeful that it's kind of fresh start and it's going to sort out their finances and stuff. But certainly in the opening and in the car ride in the film, I felt there was a lot of tension still, and that Jack Nicholson seemed kind of quite, he always seems to have the kind of barely controlled kind of irritation and contempt at all times. And in the interview as well, he's just like, he's got this kind of, I would call it a shit-eating grin, just has a kind of contempt for everyone and just superiority.
There's a sort of, for me, there's kind of a mania. It's manic. He seems very manic. He's like overly kind of happy, but it's contrived, and underneath that is something much more sinister going on. But I know what you mean.
Because there's some stuff like that, I don't know if it's more in the book, about him kind of playing with Danny, but then he plays too rough.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, it's the kind of fun that could get out of hand and that because someone could get hurt.
Yeah. He's always like on the edge. And the sort of domestic violence kind of theme of that relationship between him and his wife and him and his son, very present when we watch it now as adults. I probably didn't pick that up when I first saw it as much. I mean, obviously it's there, but I don't think I would have felt it in the way that I do now as an adult woman. I would have I've felt it very keenly now.
Because when I watched it, I was probably 18. So then watching it again, there were bits, you know, when like the scene where they're arguing and he's kind of mimicking her voice back to her in a kind of high-pitched kind of mocking voice. It was just like, and she's just crying, and it made me really upset because it was just like, I haven't heard that tone very often, but it's just that particular kind of utterly contemptuous tone is very horrible to hear. And just, it's so, you know,
So we should probably talk about like Shelley Duvall's portrayal of Wendy. So as I understand it, in the original script, Wendy had a lot more lines.
Right.
And a lot more, and it was cut out and pared down. Partly that might have been to do with Kubrick's artistic vision. Partly it might have been the fact that he didn't seem to get on very well with her and didn't seem to kind of think she was particularly good. So it could be some of that, I'm not sure. But her part is very stripped down. She doesn't have a lot. And I react to her in quite a negative way. I hate her character. I find her whiny. I find her annoying. I feel like she's very weak and kind of insipid, I guess. And she just really irritates me. But you have a different response to her, don't you?
Yeah. Although it sounds like Stephen King is with you, because I think he had a particular problem with Wendy in the film. Cue quote, Becky.
So he was interviewed in The Guardian when he was promoting Dr. Sleep, which is the sort of sequel to this film, but not obviously directed by Kubrick. And he really didn't like the way that she was portrayed. And he says that she is one of the most misogynistic characters ever put on film. She's basically just there to scream and be stupid. And someone else refers to her as Olive Oil Revisited.
I mean, that's a funny joke. Both in kind of Shelley Duvall's performance, her kind of natural appearance and the costume choices, she seems very childlike. She's kind of have these kind of like dungarees and bib dresses, and she's very kind of wide-eyed and has quite a high voice. But I guess to me, I saw that more as kind of a survival technique, that she's making herself smaller and non-threatening as a safety measure to keep herself safe, and that she's always trying to kind of protect Danny and diffuse situations and kind of displace Jack's anger. I can definitely relate to that, making yourself feel smaller so to not seem like threat or a rival, or you know.
So you said to me you see that she is actually quite strong, even though she is quite weak, because she does save him. And I think that's true. She does go to lengths to save her son, and he's very much like the driving force. Like, there's a real strong sense of her motherly love and motherly bond there. So I don't know what it is, but I just feel like She's just a really bad character. I just feel like she doesn't have enough about her. But as you say, it depends who the narrator is. Like, we don't really know who the narrator is in the film. We don't really know whose perspective we're seeing this from.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in terms of the book, we get a lot more backstory and a lot more inside the head of all the different characters.
Yeah. So we
kind of see things from all their different perspectives and as fully rounded kind of humans.
And I think that's why Stephen King reacted in the way he did to this version, even though it's widely seen as a very successful film and it often comes out on people's like top 100 list horror films of all time or whatever. The Shining's almost guaranteed to be in there somewhere. But I think for Stephen King, the characters and what he was saying about the people and those relationships is lost quite a lot in the film. The film is much more about the effect of the hotel on the people. And it does lose more of that relationship side.
Yeah, perhaps because, yeah, everything in the filmmaking is so deliberate and kind of every camera movement. I don't know if you've read about his archives and stuff. It's crazy. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Amazing. I would absolutely give my right arm to spend some time in those archives.
Because it's interesting that we've kind of almost switched places compared to like Hereditary.
Yeah. Yeah. True.
But I don't know. Maybe I was trying to kind of challenge my internalized misogyny or something. And I mean, and I knew also, I think I'd read that Shelley Duvall was treated very badly in the making of this film. When you said about the auteur theory, I was just thinking all these like kind of fabled great male auteurs that also kind of mistreated their leading ladies and stuff, like Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren, you know, Lars von Trier and everyone. And that the myth of the great man is like a get-out-of-jail-free card for a lot of bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, Roman Polanski.
Ugh. Yeah, and how could you make Rosemary's Baby? And how could you direct Faye Dunaway in Chinatown as like an incest survivor with like such delicacy? And then, yeah, just stop it.
And also, I mean, a less famous version, but his Romeo and Juliet is really quite stunning, I think. Very delicate and beautiful.
Oh wow.
But anyway, that aside, so let's go back to the beginning of the film, that tracking shot. I mean, this is often parodied and copied in other films. In fact, I've seen it copied in quite a few horror films. That the tracking of the car through the mountains with the sinister music, it's an iconic opening to a film. And it really sets the scene. You're going on a journey somewhere. You're not really sure where it's taking you, but you know it's going to be bad. And you get that real sort of creeping sense of stuff is coming, danger is in the air. And I absolutely love it. And it's also very beautiful.
Yeah, and it's also, it's almost like a kind of a malevolent force watching over as well. And then how the characters are kind of dwarfed by the landscape. And then later in the interiors of the hotel, that they're always in very big rooms, you know, filmed from far away and looking absolutely tiny. And they're kind of just like helpless to their kind of environment. Yeah, it was interesting. It reminded me of the opening of The Descent, actually. They had something quite similar to that. But yeah. I feel like in other things like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, of a similar kind of...
I can't really remember now. I mean, there's definitely a tracking shot with the car.
Evil Dead? I feel like Evil Dead, there's one like them driving to the woods.
Yeah, lots of films have it in.
Maybe it's just like, we have a helicopter.
These days it's probably a drone.
Well, yeah.
So there's the sense of isolation, which is another thing that makes it very prescient during the current times of lockdown. But obviously, there's a lot about the isolation. As you said before, they're spending their winter in this hotel with no one around. So we know they're going to be very isolated, potentially with quite challenging weather conditions because it's in a snowy sort of mountainous area. They have the potential to be cut off. And in fact, at one point, they are cut off due to the bad weather. And I think that long journey sort of compounds the sense of isolation because you get a sense of how far away they are from everything and normality. But that also kind of lends itself to the fact that maybe it's not a ghost story. Maybe he's just got cabin fever and gone insane. And that's kind of talked about the manager of the hotel when he's telling him about the job. He's saying, you know, just to let you know, the previous caretaker went mad and killed his wife and children. Was it the previous caretaker or the one a few times before? I think it was quite a while ago
because this is late 70s, and then that was kind of 40s, 50s, maybe it was 60s. I guess we see the costumes because we see the little girls, the ghosts. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, it happened sometime previously, and Jack's reaction is, oh yeah, it's fine. I think he says something like, my wife's into all of those crime novels, she'll be fine.
Oh yeah. I thought that was interesting.
Which made me laugh, just as we always talk about how women, and particularly on this podcast, are kind of interested in horror and crime and all the many, many reasons that might be. But the crux of that being, like, we know this has happened before. And is it the sense of isolation that sends somebody who's already got some issues mentally? I mean, we know that he's got issues with his drinking and that he's got anger issues and that he's going through some trouble with his wife. And also he's a struggling writer. So there's quite a lot of pressure and anxiety on him at the moment. There is a reading that all of this is kind of in his head. And that he's just flipped.
Interesting. Yeah, because there's the mention that Jack had hurt Danny before and broken his arm, but claims it's an accident, says a momentary loss of muscular coordination. And there's a lot more stuff in the book about that, the kind of guilt and anger and, you know, did he mean it? Did he not mean it? The red mist descending.
Yeah. Is it a moment of anger or is it just an accident?
And that Wendy doesn't really trust him, because then when Danny's strangled by the woman in room 237, she immediately accuses Jack of trying to hurt their son.
Yeah.
So I think that's extraordinary that she's been living with him all this time and she thinks he could hurt their child.
I mean, if she's gone through this relationship with him and he's had problems with drinking, we don't know what he's been like in the past. Perhaps he's been violent to her, and perhaps she's witnessed him being violent in the past to others. And so she knows there's a side to him that she can't trust. There's another thing that kind of adds a bit of weight potentially to the theory of cabin fever. It's been noted in a few readings of the film that there are always mirrors in the scenes where there are ghosts. And so one of the kind of possible analyses of this is that Kubrick did that to show that he's talking to himself, that actually these are reflections of him and they're not real ghosts. He's just talking to himself.
Although Danny's shining, so his psychic ability, would seem to corroborate. Although I guess the kind of the red rum stuff is just about prefiguring that murder is going to happen.
Yeah.
And it could be the threat of Jack going crazy and with an axe.
So that in itself is creepy, isn't it?
Mm.
So we've all, you know, most of us have had presumably invisible friends when we were kids or whatever. He has an invisible friend that lives in his finger. Fine. Okay. Whatever. But it's the little voice he does with it.
Yeah.
Tony, the invisible friend, has a horrible voice where he goes, red, and it's terrifying. That absolutely creeps me out. Kids are scary. In horror films, kids are always terrifying.
But it's so interesting because then in the book, I can't remember if it's kind of unclear whether he's another child or he's an adult, but like Danny sees him on the street, but then he has these kind of seizures and gets shown kind of things from the past and present and future and kind of horrible visions. Whereas it just seems like he's doing a silly voice in the film and kind of, but it's almost a suggestion that this is kind of his like spirit guide or something.
Yeah, and that's explored more in Dr. Sleep follow-up, where people with these psychic abilities are able to kind of find ways into each other's dreams and minds and talk to each other, though Tony could actually be someone trying to help him from somewhere else, and he's trying to send him a message.
Oh, that sounds really cool. Because then there's also stuff about Mr. Halloran, the cook.
Who's also a psychic. And
yes, yeah, and because Danny calls to him for help.
Yeah. And so in the film, he makes his way amazingly somehow all the way from Florida, even though all flights are grounded and there's terrible weather. He somehow gets there, seemingly in a matter of hours, and arrives on a snow plow to save the day, but then gets killed straight away with an axe.
Yeah.
Quite sad. He doesn't die in the book, does he? He survives.
No. So interesting, and like to know about the decision making there. I mean, not that there are many characters at all, but it's the only kind of character of colour. I mean, I think in the book, the handling of race is not ideal either. I think it was done from a liberal perspective of a white American guy in the 70s. but yeah. it's definitely ripe for criticism now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, he seems like the kind of exemplar of the kind of magical Negro trope.
Yeah, coming to save the day.
Yeah.
He's also psychic. Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of in terms of things like trauma and stuff, there's some really interesting readings because Mr. Halloran says the visions are just like pictures in a book. They're not real. They're almost like kind of flashbacks or kind of PTSD trigger experiences, because it's like whether things from the past can still hurt you or impact on you. You know, whether you're actually there or whether it's just a picture.
It's that interesting concept, which, you know, is sort of, I guess, the whole theory behind ghosts. This leaving a trace of itself behind, leaving an imprint, and those images are then able to be picked up by these psychic people. But yeah, there's an innate terrifying aspect to that of, can it reach back out and get you?
Yeah, it's like nightmares. Because, yeah, as soon as you wake up, you know it didn't happen. But there's no way when you're in it to get yourself out of it or convince yourself it's not actually true, even if it's completely ludicrous to your waking mind.
Very true. I just want to call back on what you just said then about the portrayal of race. I just think it's interesting to point out about the fact that it's referenced that the hotel is built on the site of a Native American Indian burial ground, which I was explaining to you before, it seems to be quite a common theme. It does reoccur in several Stephen King novels, and I don't know if that's just because he has an interest in Native American folklore and or whether the area that he lives in, which is Maine in America, has a lot. I don't know. It's not an area I'm familiar with, but it does reoccur. And it's alluded to a few times within the film. Like, there's the scene where the cook is showing them around the hotel and showing them all the food stocks. And there's a famous American brand that has a caricature of a Native American Indian on the label. And you see a lot of that in their food stores and things like that. So there's just that kind of like echo throughout it. And although they never explore it implicitly, there's always the sort of sense that maybe the sinister things are happening because of what they've done. Maybe that's why the hotel is sinister, because it's paying them back for colonizing this burial ground.
Yeah, and that seemed to be a commonly used trope in a lot of horror films of this era. Although maybe partly because a hell of a lot of them were Stephen King adaptations. But there's, yeah, Pet Sematary. But then they picked that up in the remake of that as well. And Poltergeist as well.
Can't forget that.
No. And we're discussing the kind of function of that and the meaning and where it sits ideologically. Is it kind of just acting out of white guilt, you know? But then it's also kind of quite convenient exploitation to turn kind of historical trauma into kind of boogeymen.
Yeah. And then there's also a sort of much less sinister interpretation of this is just the sort of folklore of the areas that people grew up and what they know. And the kind of history that has been passed down through the generations of the land. And so in some senses, it is part of their history, even though it's not their history.
Yeah.
So let's talk about room 237. So room 237 is a room within the hotel where Jack is warned not to go. Or is it Danny?
Danny's warned.
The cook warns Danny.
Halloran, warns him.
But it's a dangerous place. And that he should stay out of there. But he's sort of drawn to it. And as he's like cycling around on his little trike on the carpets, he does sort of find himself outside that room a few times. And also Jack is drawn to that room. And then there's an instance where he does go in there. Danny does go in there and he gets strangled by the scary dead lady that lives in the room. And then Jack has to go and investigate what's happened to see if there is anyone in the room. And he also encounters the scary dead lady, who interestingly enough is a classic horror movie trope. In she starts off as a beautiful naked woman and then becomes a decaying zombied hag.
Yeah, it comes to us all.
Yeah. Some sooner than others.
Yeah, it is really creepy. Certainly for the first time I found it more creepy the opening, where she's the beautiful woman, because she's kind of just a bit uncanny.
Yeah.
Her movements, it's just a bit kind of slowed down and her expression is a bit kind of vacant.
A hark back to Hitchcock's Psycho, just in the shower with the curtain and coming out from behind the curtain. It is a nice snapshot.
It made me think as well of, I don't know if you've seen the adaptation of Under the Skin with Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
Because when she is in her kind of weird nightmare chamber and she's kind of walking in her underwear on this shiny surface and this just blackness kind of swaying and very sexy, but very kind of cold and scary as well. And she's just basically leading all these men to their death.
Mm-hmm. So there's almost like a cult thing around Room 237. There was a documentary that was made about sort of lots of conspiracy theories and silly things around that room, which we've both seen. It's very silly, isn't it?
I think it's kind of balls.
I found it really interesting to watch as a fan of the film and a fan of Kubrick. I found it interesting to watch and fun, but I also found it quite offensive as well.
Yeah. Because I just think there's so much interesting that's actually in the film rather than freeze framing all these shadows from a curtain or something and claiming it's, you know, Little Green Men or something.
Yeah.
Just seems so laboured.
Completely. And there's a whole other thing about The Shining being a sort of allegory for the Holocaust, which I find very offensive, and I don't want to entertain that as a reading of the film. And I'm almost certain that that's not Kubrick's intention. No. But with any of these loved films, you always get people kind of like analysing every second of it and getting too obsessive about what that could possibly mean. Which, I mean, I understand as someone with OCD who really does get obsessed and thinks about things too much.
Yeah, especially with Kubrick, it's not a secret. You know, every part of the filmmaking process is documented. You know, there aren't hidden messages that not even he knows about.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
Anything more you're reading into it, you're bringing yourself. Like, there was a whole thing about the Wizard of Oz, the like the hanging munchkin in the... Do you know that urban legend thing?
No.
So it was supposed to be that like one of the munchkins took their own life during the filming of the Wizard of Oz, and then you can see their body hanging in the woods in the background. It's like such a stupid... And then there's people who just like go through freeze framing the like backgrounds of the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, that's really...
It's very distasteful.
I also would say, though, that the Wizard of Oz has a much better urban legend. Not really an urban legend.
Oh.
The thing about watching it whilst having the Dark Side of the Moon on, but you have to start the Dark Side of the Moon at the third roar of the lion in the MGM logo. And I do confess that whilst I was at university, we did do that. And it was amazing and it really matches up and it really works. But we were quite stoned. So I'm not sure on balance whether that is true. But it was a long time ago.
Good fun all around.
Good fun indeed. So there's some fantastic sort of shots in this film. You know, if you want to learn how to make films, I would definitely spend some time looking at the way Kubrick uses camera and composes different shots within the film, because it's fascinating and it's really interesting and it's used very well. One of my favourite shots, which isn't about fancy camera work, is the blood where it sort of crashes through the elevator and down the corridor in a sort of torrent. And that reoccurs a couple of times in the film. And it's such a striking scene. And it's very visual and very artistic, but also very scary. And it really sticks in your memory.
How did they do that?
I don't know. Because, you know, it's before CGI and everything. I think they probably, it looks kind of real. I don't think it's probably in the hotel. I think they probably just built a small mini stage or a little model or something.
Yeah, it's very eerie. The scale of it. How many people's blood would it have to be that much blood?
It's like a tsunami of blood. Yeah. What does it mean? It's very scary. And the other bits that are really interesting are in the maze where Shelley and Danny go into the sort of topiary maze that is in the hotel's grounds. And then that becomes a set piece at the end of the film as well. But just the shots and the use and just how they make it, I guess those things are quite scary, but how they make it so sinister is really interesting.
Oh, and something that I hadn't remembered from the first time is what Danny does when he retraces his steps and steps back into his footprints so he won't leave a trail. And I was just like, that's really clever. I just really admired that, like, kind of resourcefulness in such a terrifying scenario.
By a very small child.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So there's a couple of other things that we should probably talk about. Do you want to talk about any of the sort of key differences between the novel, because you've read it quite recently, and the film?
Well, I mean, it's a really long book. So there's loads of backstory about the hotel, the history of the hotel, the different eras of it, and various crimes that have been committed there, and murders, and kind of the dark past. And there's also a lot more characterization of the hotel as a kind of entity. And that there's a lot of discussion of like the management. So there's like all the ghosts are kind of just part of a kind of wider evil entity and consciousness that has its own goals and ends that all the others are just kind of players in.
Yeah, they do make reference to that very briefly within the film, I think. I can't remember whether it's Lloyd the bartender or when Grady comes back. We meet Grady, the previous caretaker, but this time he's a waiter working in the sort of ballroom when Jack goes into the ballroom and it's the past. Either one of those makes reference to the management. But it's not explored in any way. But it gives that extra sinister level of like, somebody else is in control of this. There is kind of a omnipotence to it, isn't there?
And also, I mean, as we've talked about a bit, the characters are a lot more fleshed out. Jack is a lot more sympathetic. He talks about his complicated feelings towards his own father, his kind of history of alcoholism, his struggles with anger, but then also comes out how much he loves Danny and how much he loves Wendy and how hard he's trying to kind of be his best self.
I was going to say, we don't get a sense of that in the film.
No.
He goes over to the evil side far too quickly. Like,
yeah.
There's less sense of good within him.
Yeah, from the start, he seems kind of simmering with kind of low-level rage. And then the character of Wendy is, I mean, I think she has some of the same elements in the book in that she's kind of a bit naive and always trying to paper over the cracks and keep everything nice. But then also there's kind of stuff that they've talked about, divorce before, and Danny's overheard it, and that they'd had a lot of rows as well over his alcoholism and, you know,
she's much more passive in the film.
Yeah.
You don't get the sense that she sort of kind of stood up to him in that sense.
No. And also, as we talked about, Mr. Halloran survived and played quite an integral role in the escape of Wendy and Danny in the book. And also an element that I believe they wanted to film, but I think it would have been really hard, was in the maze, there are kind of topiary animals. And in the book, they kind of come alive. And it's almost like the weeping angels in Doctor Who, that every time you look away, they're a bit closer.
I think that does occur in Doctor Sleep, but I can't remember whether it does or whether I've just... because I can see it in my mind's eye. And I don't know whether that's because I remember it from Doctor Sleep or whether it's just from being in my mind's eye from having read the novel. I'm just not
sure. Yeah, because it is very vivid.
Yeah.
Because it's really scary. It's just... that there's no getting away and what they might do, but it seems so ridiculous as well.
This is like zombies, isn't it? We've talked about that before. There's something terrifying about that slow relentlessness, even though realistically we all know that you could get away. There's still something scary about it. And it's the same with the weeping angels in Doctor Who. They're unnecessarily terrifying, even though really they're quite like naff when you look at them. But
no.
It's scary.
We had a flickering light in the toilets at work and I used to play Weeping Angel with myself.
That must have made going to the toilet quite terrifying.
Well, it's good for your movements. So, I mean, yeah, I can see that with 1980s CGI, that could have been terrible. And it's the kind of thing that could look good or could look really silly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I understand that as an omission.
The other core difference is the ending.
Hmm.
So in the ending of the book, I think there's a sense that Jack actually gets a hold of himself and remembers himself and is able to sort of fight against the evil from the hotel for just enough time for Danny to get away, whereas you don't get that sense in the film. And also at the end, the whole hotel blows up because he's not maintained the boiler.
Yes.
It all blows up. And I think I read that Kubrick didn't want to blow up the hotel because it's more sinister to know it's still out there, to sort of know the presence is still continuing. That kind of is much more scary than it going.
Yeah, I guess I can see that. Mm-hmm. I mean, also it would have been a massive pain in the arse.
Probably quite expensive.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So the hotel itself that's used is a real hotel. I think it still exists. It is beautiful. It's in a beautiful location, but it will forever be sinister in my mind. So where I grew up in rural Wales, we only had one proper hotel, and it was on the side of a cliff, and it had a 70s carpet, and it was not the same 70s carpet. It was a different colour. It was green, I think. I don't think it was the orange and red of the iconic carpet from the film. It was similar. And I used to have to, for various reasons, when I was a child, I spent quite a lot of time having to go to that hotel and walk through the corridors of that hotel. And I always remember that it reminded me of the scene in the film just because of the 70s carpet. 70s carpet gives me nightmares. Yeah, there's something scary about like huge hotels with no one in them. For some reason, that is just kind of scary. Maybe not if you work in a hotel, but to me, that seems quite scary.
There's so many places to hide, I guess.
So the final thing that I wanted to touch on as we're talking about the carpet is the sort of, again, iconic scene often parodied in other films of Danny on his little children's trike cycling through the hotel corridors, which in itself is so innocent. It's actually kind of cute. It's a child cycling along the corridors on his own. But the way it's filmed, it becomes really scary. And there's a really interesting thing about sound, because he's on carpet and then he hits the wooden floor and then he goes on carpet again and there's a different noise and you follow him and the camera's quite low and it's tracking him. And there's this ball, like a kid's ball, that appears out of nowhere. And then he sees the scary girls and he sees the blood shot that we've already talked about. So there's a lot of scary things that happen to him. But before any of the scary things happen, it's still really terrifying. Just this image of this child cycling alone through the hotel. And that is one of those things that really does stick with me. And I, when I think about images that I find scary, that's one of those things that sticks in my mind and I think about, and I don't really know why, but it obviously had such an impact on me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you spent a lot of time rattling around on your own as a small child.
I don't know. I don't think I was scared a lot as a child.
I was.
But I know that there were times where I was. And so I think it probably picks up on that sort of primal instinct fear that you get. That fear of somebody watching him. Like, you know, there's something there and somebody's watching him and something's going to get him. And I guess it's a kind of survival instinct fear of wanting to protect the child that flashes up into your mind.
Yeah, because I think, and certainly reading the book, I found it very moving and sad, kind of Danny's perspective on everything. Because him seeing all this stuff that he's not really able to understand, you know, both just kind of grown-up stuff, like sex and, you know, his parents' marriage and stuff, and also kind of horrific stuff, you know, that he doesn't really have a way to understand. And that he's kind of just a normal kid, but also he's so haunted. And it seems such a weight on him.
They do reflect upon that again in Dr. Sleep, and it's interesting to think about him as an adult. With the benefits of hindsight, if he'd been able to understand what he was being told, he could have stopped it. I mean, he couldn't have, because he was a small child and his parents wouldn't have listened to him. But he had the tools to know what was going to happen, but he was too small to understand, as you say, what any of that meant. So there's probably a level of guilt that he will always sort of live with as an older person.
Yeah. So does the adult Danny still have the shining?
He does, yes. And he learns to use it in different ways. He tries to ignore it, but then he has to go back.
Because, yeah, I mean, I think the performance of the young boy is really good as well. I mean, he just seems incredibly kind of haunted and not childlike, or just because he seems so controlled and inside himself all the time.
Yeah, definitely. His mother's much more emotionally fragile and sort of jumpy, and he's, yeah.
Because he's almost kind of checked out, isn't he? He's just like, almost seems kind of dissociating. He doesn't cry out. He just, like, his eyes get bigger and bigger and he's just like, oh no.
Yeah.
You know, too much.
Can't compute.
Yeah.
There's a strong level of like trauma there for a small child, for sure. So ultimately, it's a film that stuck with me for a long time. I still find it scary. So before we did this, I watched it again and I've seen it loads of times. Every time I watch it, I see something new in it. And yeah, I still find it has an impact on me. there's a really interesting thing that I cannot understand about the film. Like, it doesn't explain it to you. The book does more of explaining to you the sort of history of the hotel and kind of a bit how the hotel sort of works, but you don't get a sense of that in the film. And so at the end of the film, we see this picture. I think it says, I can't remember the date on it. I know it's the 4th of July, but I think it's like 1931, maybe? Not sure. And this picture appears on the wall of the hotel, and Jack is now in that picture. And obviously he didn't exist, or he wasn't alive then, now died and appears in the picture. And so there's this interesting thing about, how does he get there? Are there two versions of him? Is there a version that was in the past and then he's drawn back there? Is he sucked back into the past? Is that all a completely fake thing that the hotel kind of has fabricated? And all of these questions go unanswered. Which I think just adds to the overall horror of it, really.
Yeah, definitely a kind of out of time element, because there's kind of when he goes to the gold room and he is in a kind of bygone era and it's all very sophisticated and stuff, and kind of everyone raises a glass of champagne to him, and, you know, despite him still being scruffy old Jack Nicholson. And then the previous caretaker is there as a waiter, but seems to have some sort of amnesia, and then claims that Jack has always been the caretaker.
Yeah, and I think at one point Lloyd, the bartender, says something like, everyone knows you, when he seems surprised that he knows his name. Mm-hmm. So there's a sense of, like, he's always been there, but he hasn't. And, like, how does that all link together?
Yeah, because are the ghosts echoes from their respective times? Are they all in some sort of limbo together? Is the hotel its own world, its own time zone?
And I think, you know, when films have that ambiguity, that's probably why people come up with all of these crazy conspiracy theories. Mm. And I think what Kubrick wanted to do was probably explore the relationship between a boy being scared of his father and also the hotel as a sinister character and presence. And I think there's probably not much more to it than that. So I really hope that we have done this justice, because, as I say, this is one of my favourite films, so I was a bit nervous about discussing this. But I'm glad that we got an opportunity to talk about it. And I do hope people go and watch it, or have watched it already, because we've probably ruined it by now.
Yeah, I also was really happy to revisit it. I guess I was 18 when I saw it. I remembered that it was quite good, but then just the way it's incredibly made, incredibly suspenseful, and very, very interesting from a lot of angles. So thanks, Becky.
No problem. Thank you very much for listening. Do catch up with us on social media. You can find us on Twitter at Panic Pixies, and also on Facebook as Panic Pixie Screen Girls, and also on Instagram as Panic Pixies. We look forward to seeing you there soon. Take care. Bye now. Thank you for listening to Panic Pixie Screen Girls, a podcast by Holly Parsons and Becky Lewis-Jones. Editing by Gareth Lewis-Jones. See you next time.